Welcome back as we head into hour three. A delight to do so with our good buddy Sam Stone at Sam the Paul over at Twitter X Twix. He is, among other things, a political consultant and a radio host. His show, Breaking Battlegrounds, is heard here on this station, Patriot, 960 AM, every Saturday morning at 9 AM. How are you, Sammy?
Seth, I am always so pleased to be on air with my friend Seth, last name. I forgot what I was going to say.
Young David, my producer, says that you're having ethnic food tonight.
Yes, doing the Persian room, which I have never been to, but I hear is fantastic.
It is fantastic. I have been there any number of times. And the problem is after you eat there, you will never want to eat anywhere else again.
Oh,
yeah,
dear.
I know.
I know. This is dangerous.
Yeah,
Beth.
I know.
I feel like I needed to be warned before I made the reservation.
No. If all I could do is eat at the Persian room and the Dirty Drummer, I would be a happy man. I know it's a wide berth, but that is the two just unmistakably, consistently great restaurants.
Well, look, I know the secret of the Drummer.
Yeah.
Because those grilled wings are just insanely great.
Yeah.
Like, it's bizarre that you can turn a chicken wing into that.
I know.
If this is in that category as a meal, I'm going to have problems. I mean, this
the quality might be and the style might be a little different. It's certainly more ornate. But man, go get some of that great rice, get some of those great kebabs, lamb, chicken, whatever you prefer. Maybe a mix would be a good idea, a mixed grill. You're gonna be happy on this choice. Is there a third chair now that I'm thinking about it?
Now I'm literally sitting here drooling.
Yeah.
Beth, my goodness.
Yeah. All right. Let's get you back on. Let's get you back on our quotidian matters here, Sammy. Let me ask you to wear your political consultant's hat for a sec, Sam Stone. Do you think that there is going to be monumental or moderate or marginal shifts from traditional voting blocks for the presidency in 2024, namely African American, Black, and Jewish American?
Not monumental, but you don't need it to be. Okay. I think there is going to be a marginal shift, and with the nature of our elections, marginal is significant.
Okay.
So,
okay.
You know, it may be a moderate shift when it comes to the Black community.
Okay.
I think there's sort of an underreported thing that's going on that obviously the broader press doesn't want to touch on with both the Black and Hispanic communities,
yeah.
Which is the combination of the transgender agenda,
mm-hmm.
and illegal immigration.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And you have families that are historically more religious, do
yep.
not like this transgender stuff, really have a cultural issue with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, that are deeply affected. It's always the lower income rungs that are most deeply affected by immigration. And they can see this. They can also see, you know, I think particularly in the Black community, how ridiculous it is that here we have all these homeless people on the streets, we have all these problems, and yet somehow liberal governments and liberal leaders across this country, leftist leaders, are finding ways to house, feed, and do absolutely everything for illegal immigrants who have come here in the last few years. It's disconcerting. I've talked to enough Black folks who say it's really disconcerting that here you have the Democrat Party that basically promised them all of this stuff decades, never delivered, and then all of a sudden is delivering it to 10 million people here illegally.
Yeah. It's been going on for some, obviously, time now, obviously, at least since the 1960s, particularly with the African American and Black vote. And one wondered at what point, or one wonders at what point, the message would be received. Look at the major cities where you have heavy concentrations of Black voters, Detroit, Chicago, LA, you know the Philly, you know the cities, New York, DC. They're all wholly owned by the Democratic Party, the city councils, the mayors, the governors
the
of those
schools,
states. The schools. Thank you for that. Yes, 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 the schools and school boards. And the communities are not doing well by any statistical or political or economic analysis. They're just not doing well. So one wonders at what point they wake up. Is the Democratic Party to keep them in a deep and lethal slumber by just sending more and more money to the top, to the grass tops of those voters' organizations or voters' civic organizations or voters' political organizations or nonprofits? Is that the plan? Because at a certain point, and I don't know if it's anecdotal, but you do see, especially on social media, more and more minority voters saying they're done with the Democratic Party. It might be anecdotal, but at some point we wondered when the slumber would cease.
Well, that was absolutely the plan, and it remains the plan. I mean, look, if you look at the facts, every black community leader who steps up, you know, especially as agitators, the BLM people, Sharpton and Jackson and company, somehow they all end up massively wealthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, the analog to that is that there are a lot of grassroots leaders who are equivalent to them on the right.
Yeah.
Who will spend their lives living on the edge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because realistically, activism is not something that should generate huge profits for the people at the top of the food chain.
Amen to that, brother. Well said.
And yet it does.
Yeah.
On their side. And then there's no progress underneath it.
Yep.
And yeah, I think at some point you are going to see real pushback. Now, I think this cycle, you know, if Trump moves to 15, 20, 25%, if he gets 25% of the black vote, it's going to be a landslide.
That will be. Yes. Yes. And I suppose it matters in certain states, too. Let's look at the Jewish vote for a second. In modern history, i.e. since you and I have been alive, the biggest vote getter of Jews who was a Republican presidential candidate was Ronald Reagan in 1980, got almost 40% of the Jewish vote. Nothing's really come more than 30% since. And 30 was a hard reach. I believe Donald Trump got it in the last go round. That having been said, this year is different. And you see the Bill Ackmans and people like that. But they have this allergy, man. What is it? Is it abortion? What is the Jewish allergy to the Republican Party? And will Robert Kennedy Jr. be the recipient of that possible desertion of the party? And will there be a desertion? Three or four or five questions there for you.
Well, let's reverse the order.
Okay.
Because I think actually take it in the track of the voter path, right?
Okay.
Which
okay.
is, will they abandon the Democrat Party?
Yep.
Will they go somewhere else?
Yeah.
I think a significant portion will indeed go to Kennedy as long as he's on the ballot in their state.
Yep.
I think there are some who will simply sit it out.
Okay.
Because, yes, they are allergic to the Republican brand. Now, that may partially be abortion. I don't think that's the major issue.
Okay.
I think it is a social contagion in their circles.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just the peer pressure, the power of peer pressure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is very, very uncomfortable to be a Republican in society circles.
Yep.
And so I think that is a bigger holdback than, you know, any other particular thing or particular issue.
Mm-hmm. And it's deep within the Jewish soul in the sense that Jewish Americans, Sam, you feel free to disagree if you don't agree with my analysis. Jewish Americans, by and large, have wanted nothing more than to be accepted. That is to say, to be assimilated. And it's the exact opposite of that to say I'm supporting Trump. That is a one-way ticket to being isolated, not assimilated, right?
And that is the position that makes Jewish Americans most uncomfortable.
Okay. All right.
It being hung out there from their friend group is the most difficult
thing, or the clubs they want to join. And I don't just mean country club. Let me take a break. Can we pick up on this? Because, I mean, this is the kind of question you and I probably get more than any other when we start talking about voting blocks and the Republicans versus the Democrats. And then let's go back to RFK Jr. too. And will it matter maybe in some states? Maybe. I'll get all of that from Sam Stone when we come right back. Also want to talk about an interview he did on his show Breaking Battlegrounds about who's funding these leftist movements. Sam Stone and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. Sam Stone is my guest, political consultant, radio host, Breaking Battlegrounds, very active Twix feed. You want to follow him at Sam the Paul, P-O-L. So, Sam, it's hard to communicate this, but I guess the point I would reiterate is when it comes to the Jewish American vote or the American Jewish vote, Jews in America, by and large, are in a weird and different place from almost any other ethnic sector in politics because more than anything else, they just want to assimilate. They just want to be accepted. They want to be in the clubs. They wanted to be in the colleges. They wanted to be in the you name it. They don't want to be thought of as
A legacy from World War II from Germany.
Right. Of course.
Of that, right?
Of course.
So
yes.
Many of the families of Jews that emigrated here before the war in particular, one of the reasons they did so was because they were being shut out of those type of systems in their home country.
That's right. That's right. And ultimately had to struggle not to be shut out here, whether they were colleges or country clubs, that sort of thing. Brandeis was founded the university because there were quotas on Jews at places like Harvard, right?
Beverly Hills Country Club.
There you go.
Exists.
Exactly.
Because the country club in that area would not allow Jews.
That's right. Sure. And we can name a couple in Arizona that came as a result of others that wouldn't. So, yes, absolutely. You know the old Barry Goldwater joke? He wanted to join a certain country club. I'd rather not get into which one, but he wanted to join a certain country club. And they said, Mr. Goldwater, being Jewish, we can't accept you. He said, I'm only half Jewish. I'll just play nine holes. Had you ever heard that before?
I haven't heard that. That's brilliant.
But, there is this weird thing. The great sociologist Milton Himmelfarb once said Jews earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. And it is because of this dynamic. They want to be Episcopalians, but it was traditionally, I suppose, that set of Republicans, which they saw as the set that kind of kept them out, and the Democratic Party being the party of the ethnic base, seemed more politically attractive to him. But then here's the catch, Sam.
Also,
go ahead.
From that period from 1948 through about 1990, whatever.
Yeah.
From Israel's founding through Bill Clinton, Democrats were the champion of Israel.
That's right. That's right. That's a huge part of it. That's a huge part of it. And we can't ignore that. And we'll come back to that as you want, if you want. But here's the funny thing, and I'm just going to go one step deeper sociologically. No matter how much the Jews tried to assimilate, as they learned this year, you can't do it enough. And there's, you can't do it. Whether you are, the most assimilated Jewish person on a campus, or whether you're a member of the Chabad student group or what have you at the campus, you are going to be targeted by the hate. By the anti-Semites, by the Jew haters.
Yes.
And so what party defends you? That becomes the, I think, tangible or most important question. That's what I think.
I think that's part of it. But I think your tangible nature runs into a lot of societal programming.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
I would also add that historically, in America in particular, and it's been a growing movement in Israel in the last couple of decades, Jews have been divided into sort of two camps.
Okay.
The one camp that says, I am a proud Jew and nothing you can say will diminish my self-worth.
Right.
The other is, well, we weren't accepted and we want to be accepted. And as long as you accept us, then we can give up all the facets of our life that are explicitly Jewish.
Yeah. Right.
And so there's Jews who are proud, standing strong for being who they are, and there are Jews who, quite frankly, would rather be anything else they could be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, right now what we're seeing is a big part of that divide. where a lot of, for instance, Jewish professors on campus have divided into two groups, the ones who are appeasing and you know, trying to go along with all of this nonsense we're seeing on campus, and those who are stepping up and saying it's unacceptable. But notice the ones who are stepping up and saying it's unacceptable. They can't go with all the, you know, they can't overcome their programming. They're
that's
not here
right.
Voting
that's,
for Donald
that's
Trump.
That's right. That's the conundrum that I'm wrestling with on how this is going to shake out, which is why I think hanging for their option is Robert Kennedy Jr.
Yes. And look, at the end of the day for Donald Trump, a vote for Kennedy from those folks is just as good as a vote for him.
Is there a state or several states you think this could make a massive difference?
Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania. I mean, look, there's beyond just him oddly having become my favorite U.S. senator since he got out of the speech therapy rehab thing
I know.
Which is really bizarre. I owe John Fetterman a lot of apologies.
Yeah.
But there's a reason he's standing up so strongly for Israel and for against anti-Semitism, and it's because you have a very large Jewish population in that state that's ticked.
Yes, it's that, and I think it's that and this kind of Ed Koch Democrat or Joe Lieberman Democrat, which is to say we're liberal, but we're not crazy. And a state like Israel, if nothing else, is perhaps the most liberal state or nation state in the world. It might be. It might be.
I think it was 15 years ago. I think a bunch of European states have managed to surpass it in that regard.
Okay.
I mean, they're really dedicated to committing self-immolation in Europe right now.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that point. Yeah. But it is interesting that in the height of the second Gulf War, or the war in Iraq, I guess is the better way to put it, in 2004, people may forget that Ed Koch actually endorsed George W. Bush, spoke at the Republican convention.
Yep.
And I don't know that we'll get that from Fetterman, but he's of that ilk, I think.
He is of that ilk. And so one of the interesting things, I think, is that I really don't – it's funny. There's something that happens with people who have served as mayors.
Yeah.
The Republicans who served as mayors sort of become less good as Republicans and less good as as politicians because they kind of give in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you see that basically 100% of the time. I don't mean to be too harsh.
I'm running some through my head. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yes. On the other hand, Democrats who become mayors, not of the big cities now I'm talking about, but of the smaller towns.
Yeah.
The big cities operate on a totally different level. But the smaller towns, there's a practicality to it.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to run a city of 100,000 people or less, it's not really much about left-right politics. It's just about how much do we have in the budget here that we can get done.
And I'm going to break. You tell me if I'm right or wrong about this. You know city government better than anyone I know. Who gives you less of a headache? What side gives you less of a headache? Let me take a quick break. Sam Stone is my guest. Ian, I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Sam Stone is my guest, and he is a political consultant who also hosts his own radio show, heard right here every Saturday morning, Breaking Battlegrounds. I'm going to talk to him in a few moments about one of his more recent guests on that show. But, Sam, we were just talking about mayors and city government, and not the huge cities, not your Chicago's and Philly's, but smaller cities. The Democratic mayors are the mayors who may get elected on the Democratic line. They get a certain waking up. They get a certain waking up because they realize what? Unions, pressure groups, neighborhood the left makes their life miserable.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
By the way, I got to correct one thing you said before we go further, and it only requires one correction. You said Republican mayors generally don't do better. Hugh Hallman is an example of the opposite. He's the exception that proves the rule. I think you'd agree with me.
I would agree. I think there are mayors out there who have held up, right?
Yeah.
But generally...
Yeah, no, generally you're right. 90% of the time you're right. Anyway, my point about headaches, right?
Yes.
The groups that cause headaches, they're not on the right.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, the interesting thing is when you're in a local government and people on the right are hassling you.
Yeah.
It's for things that you can totally understand and likely agree or sympathize with, at least,
yep,
right?
Yep.
So it's like, hey, crime is up. We want more cops.
Yes, right.
Okay.
Right.
Like, there's no fire station within 15 minutes of us. We need a fire station.
Okay.
Well, yeah,
yes.
I mean, it's going to be a few bucks, but
sure,
we can do that.
Yeah.
The Democrats will come in and be like, we demand racial justice, social equity of tree distribution,
yes,
in community. And you're like, what the heck?
Tree equity? What? Yeah, all right. Stop. What the? Yeah, right.
Stop.
Right.
How about you just show up and you're like, hey, can we plant more trees?
Bridge equity
like,
is the new
fine
one. Yeah, you've heard of that.
Right.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, look, they're gobbledygook.
Mm-hmm.
And at the local level, it's impossible to satisfy them.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the things people didn't get, and I understood, and Sal DiCicco and his office understood with the anti-police protest movement. You know, one of their first demands was body cams for all the cops.
Okay.
And neither of us thought that was a bad idea, although when they first started demanding it, the technology just wasn't there.
Yeah.
Like, they had them, but the storage technology and all that kind of thing, it just was not ready,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're sitting there going, we're not opposed to body cams, but here's the problem. We kept saying this to the other council members, and none of them understood this. This isn't about body cams. Whatever you do, it will not be enough.
Right.
Because these groups, and it ties into the next thing we're talking about,
yep,
which is the interview with Jeffrey Reynolds,
yep,
and what's going on behind the scenes with all of these liberal billionaires, leftist billionaires,
yep,
and all their orgs funding this.
Yep.
These are paid antagonists.
Okay.
If you give them what they want and they agree that that's what they wanted and they don't want anything more, then they're out of a job.
Yeah.
Their job is to create chaos and you know, craziness.
Yep.
And to keep pushing no matter what.
Yep.
So, you know, first you get body cams, and then you get different policies, and then you get civilian review, and then you end up with the DOJ coming in and overseeing your department.
Yep.
And then you end up handing millions of dollars to everybody who doesn't deserve it. So that now you get flooded with lawsuits, and it just tears your police department apart. This is what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the difference is that when you're dealing with people on the right,
mm-hmm,
in local government,
mm-hmm,
you're dealing with people who have a concrete fit and set objective, and once that objective is achieved,
mm-hmm,
they're out of your hair.
Yes, right, right.
They're right. You know, they're grateful, they're happy, they're voting for you. Everybody wins. But when you deal with the left, whatever you've just given them,
mm-hmm,
is simply the next move in their chess game.
Yep, yep.
And if they can make you absolutely crazy along the way, they will do it. They're awful to deal with.
Yep. We used to call them professional busybodies and meddlers. It's gotten far worse now. I mean, I think it's converted. I mean, it has. I know it has. It's converted a lot of civic activists themselves. For example, your friend, the Reverend, in town here, right?
Jared Maupin, yeah.
Jared Maupin. I mean, at a certain point, you know, he couldn't take it anymore, right?
It's converting a lot of the ones who are interested in their community and not their self-enhancement.
Yep. Yep. Let me pick it,
you get a lot of money. You get a lot of money for being a leftist agitator.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a fair point. Let's talk about that money when we come back in your interview with Jeff Reynolds. Sam Stone and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Sam Stone is my guest. Follow him on Twitter, X Twix, at Sam the Paul, P-O-L. He has his own radio show heard here every Saturday morning's Breaking Battlegrounds. You and I were, as many have been, fascinated by a piece over at The Tablet, The People Setting America on Fire. You interviewed an expert related to these issues, Jeffrey Reynolds, who has, I guess, a book on this. Tell us about, where is all this money coming from? Who's funding these organizations, and who are these college campus rabble-rousing organizations?
Well, so what's interesting is it's a mix of America's big old money foundations. Mm-hmm. So the Ford Foundation, the Kaiser Family Foundation, mm-hmm. the Rockefeller Family Foundation. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, some of the newer ones like George Soros and his Open Society Network. But if you remember, there was a big brouhaha, about a decade ago, right, where all the leftist punditry was going berserk over the Koch network.
Right.
Right? Right. Which, what the Kochs were doing was bringing together a bunch of the wealthier Republican donors in the country and trying to map out a unified course of what they would do each year, right?
Yep.
And if you remember, the left media went absolutely ape over this.
Yep.
You know, but here's the thing. This has been going on since the 30s on the left, with all these groups coming together multiple times a year to lay out who's going to do what in seek of their aims. And they drove away the people and the mission of these institutions at their start. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Kaiser Family Foundation, for instance, is exactly what it sounds like. It was designed to support family development.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's an organization that advocates for the type of programs that actually limit people's ability to create and build families, mm-hmm. the leftist welfare state and dependency programs. The boards were taken over so that by the 1970s, the last member of the Ford family no longer served on the Ford Family Foundation board.
Uh-huh.
Now, some have come back in the recent years because now you're getting this hardcore leftism that's invading the ultra-elite, especially those, you notice, who did not earn the wealth themselves.
That's right. It's always, yep.
Mm-hmm. Right? That mm-hmm. second generation yep. that inherited or yep. third generation.
Usually
that
the
inherited,
third. Yeah, right. Yep. Third and fourth.
Vast
right,
yep. wealth.
Right.
But did nothing themselves for it.
Right. Right.
A lot of them are falling to this. And so these groups have created this massive network, and they funnel huge sums of money. I mean, there's a reason that you saw these protests. I think it was Princeton where all the green tents first showed up, the yeah. identical green tents, yeah. right? Green yeah. being the color of Islam.
Right.
Those things cost real money. Mm-hmm. And yes, students at an Ivy League school, by and large, could afford them.
Mm-hmm.
But we know they didn't because they had other things like weed and booze mm-hmm. to go spend their money on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So who bought them?
Mm-hmm.
These organizations did. And mm-hmm. these organizations have co-opted these street protest kids. They started really co-opting this current movement as Jeffrey Reynolds, who we had on the program. You can follow him on X at Charger Jeff. Which unfortunately is not a reference to the car. He's a Chargers fan, which
yes.
I'll give him credit, you know, beautiful uniforms, but,
yes.
but you know, otherwise it's
yeah.
terrible. But
yeah.
anyway,
yeah.
But
at least since Jack Kemp
started,
played for them.
Yes.
I think he was
exactly
with them one
right.
season. I think one season.
but they started with the Occupy Wall Street movement,
mm-hmm.
Where they went and basically bought the leadership of that protest movement
yep.
at that time and then have done it ever since.
Yeah.
So to control these movements, they buy them and they're behind them. So if you're wondering where those giant pallets of bricks came for in the Summer of Love.
Right.
It's from these people.
Right.
It's very likely that some of the wealthiest people in America put pallets of bricks on the street to tear down our own cities.
Yes,
with.
Yes, yes. It's as
and,
if Saul Alinsky was given $1 billion.
Well, he's been given billions upon billions
okay,
of dollars.
Fair enough.
These groups are now spending literally billions more every year than right side donors are.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
And billions of dollars a year, Seth. Yeah. It is a massive. So now you're seeing, like here in Arizona, for instance, all of our state house and senate races, our candidates get outspent like 5-1 or more.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, where's that coming from? Because at the end of the day, there are more wealthy Republicans and successful Republicans in this state than there are Democrats.
Yep. Yep.
So where's this money coming from?
Right.
How are they beating us by this much? It's these organizations, and it's likely that they are money laundering through Act Blue, pretending that these are small dollar donations that are filtering down. But it is literally not possible for Blue to generate the amount of small dollar donations they claim to generate each year.
Okay.
Okay.
It's so skewed. And so there's a huge structure of money behind it. And understand, for these folks, as long as they stay on top and in power, nothing else matters. And the reason they've chosen these movements and these leaders that they're choosing is because they're controllable with money.
Yep. That's a problem with a lot of these organizations. One of the things, and I think your guest gets into this a little bit as well, but one of the things I picked up from the Tablet article, The People Setting America on Fire, is the title of it, is there's a lot of questionable people behind a lot of these organizations too. People that should themselves be on terrorist watch lists and investigated by the DOJ, like we did in the 1990s, like we did with a lot of these Muslim, quasi-Muslim terrorist organizations built here in America, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, so the indiscriminate,
the Holy Land
of
Foundation
funding,
stuff, yeah, right.
Well, there's a separate stream of funding that comes from all those Arab countries, right?
Yep.
And wealthy Emirates and that sort of thing.
Yep.
So that's one stream of funding for this. And what they're doing, if you know, for people who haven't been paying enough attention, what they're doing is buying off violence in their country by buying violence for other
countries.
Yes.
Well put. Well, praise be God, Donald Trump gets reelected. We get a serious attorney general, and he starts investigating the hell out of this. That's my prayer.
Oh, yeah. I on Hersia Lee, who I'm a big fan of, posted a thing today from another Muslim just saying, hey, you know, fellow Muslims, we have to have a talk.
Yeah.
Like, it's us, not them kind of thing, right?
Good.
And then immediately
would you send that to me? Would you send that
yes,
to me?
Yes, I certainly will.
Thank you.
And then immediately in the comments, you see all these Muslims coming on, you traitors, you should be, you know, blah, blah, blah. Listen, if I was Trump and Trump's Border Patrol, ICE, whatever, I would go through that list, identify every one of those people, and airdrop them back to their countries tomorrow.
Bingo. Sam Stone, thank you, and God bless, sir.
You too, Seth.
Talk to you soon. Whenever I think of city politics and Democrats and voting blocks, and it could be translated nationally beyond the municipal, I go back to something William Buckley wrote in his book, The Unmaking of a Mayor, where when he was running for mayor, he was asked about voting blocks, and he said, as far as politicians are concerned, you have Irishmen, Italians, blacks, they are union members or white-collar workers or welfare recipients or city employees. You have Catholics, Protestants, Jews. You have taxi drivers and taxi owners, merchants and policemen. And the problem is to weigh the voting strength of all the categories and formulate a program that least dissatisfies the least crowded and least powerful categories. And the victory is supposed to go to the most successful bloc. And in an interview he did, someone asked him, what's the matter with that? And he said, what is the matter is that you reach the point where it faces the marginal disutility of bloc satisfaction. The race to satisfy the bloc, the group, finally ends in dissatisfying even the individual members of that bloc. If, for example, you give taxi owners the right to limit the number of taxis available in the city, people who need taxis to get from where they are to where they want to go can't find taxis when they most want them. If you allow truck drivers to double park because it's convenient to them and to the merchants whose goods they are unloading, traffic is snarled and taxi drivers can't move fast enough to make a decent living. When the traffic is snarled, people stay away from the city and the merchants lose money. If the merchants lose money, they want to automate in order to save costs. If the unions don't let them automate, they leave the city. When they leave the city, there are fewer people to pay taxes to city officials and to the unemployed. Taxes have to go up because there are fewer people to pay them. The unemployed grow restless and breed children in crime. The children drop out of school because there isn't anyone at home to tell them to go to school. Some of the children who go to school make school life intolerable for other children in school, and they leave and go to private schools. Teachers are told they mustn't discourage the school children or they will leave the schools and commit crime and unemployment. The unions don't have the unemployed hired because they will work for less money or because they are minorities and obviously can't lay bricks or wire buildings like white people can, so they are supposed to go off somewhere and just live and stay out of the way. But they can't live except in houses, and houses are built by plumbers and electricians who get $8, $10, and $12 an hour, which means that people can't afford to buy houses, this was 1965, or rent apartments at rates the city can afford to pay its unemployed, so the federal government has to build housing projects. But there aren't enough housing projects, so there is overcrowding and family life disintegrates. Some people turn to crime, others to ideology. And then you can't walk from one end of New York to another without standing a good chance of losing your wallet, your maidenhead, or your life, or without being told that white people are bigoted, that minorities are shiftless, that free enterprise is the enemy of the working class. And the only thing that will save your city is for the whole of the United States to become like it. William Buckley. Couldn't have done it better. Prescient. David Dahl, thank you. Mr. Bill, thank you. Ms. Terry, thank you. Thank you all. Until tomorrow, I'm Seth Leibson. God bless and class dismissed.